Good afternoon. It's Monday the 28th of January 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. On my own in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen, unfortunately ill with the flu. I hope Patrick gets well very soon. But I am delighted to say we're joined today by David Ellis via Skype. Welcome to the programme, David.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good to be here.
Yeah, good. Okay, so we're going to get straight on, David, with constitutional issues, because the Constitution has suddenly become a very large part of the Brexit debate, it seems. Now, I want to start off here by just reading through how the Ministry of Justice defined the British Constitution up until a couple of years ago. They said the British Constitution is not, as in many countries, a written constitution. It is not codified in a single document, but it's made up of a complex web of statutes, conventions, and a corpus of common and other law. It is also informed by an interweaving of history and more modern democratic principles. The legal premise of the United Kingdom Constitution, that the UK Parliament is sovereign, is a fundamental part of our constitutional arrangements. This means that an act of Parliament must be obeyed by the courts, that later acts prevail over earlier ones, and that the rules made by external bodies cannot override acts of Parliament. The Bill of Rights, 1689, and the Magna Carta are important elements of our Constitution. Magna Carta is primary legislation and has the same status as other legislation and is not immune from repeal or amendment. The same applies to the Bill of Rights, which was an ordinary act of Parliament passed in the ordinary way. So that's what the Ministry of Justice had to say on their website up until a couple of years ago. They haven't replaced, they've taken this down now, but they haven't replaced it with anything more recent. But David, this piece of text has so many errors and outright lies, it's unbelievable. So first of all, they say, as you can see on screen there, it is not a written constitution. Well, of course, okay, it's not written as in other countries, because other countries have a constitution in a single document. But as they say, it is in statutes, conventions, common law, but nonetheless, it is written. It's informed by an interweaving of history and more democratic principles. The principle that Parliament is sovereign, this is not correct constitutionally. We've got a tripartite arrangement, House of Commons, House of Lords. The Crown in Parliament is a very important part of this, despite the fact that the current incumbent doesn't seem to recognise her constitutional role at the moment. They say that acts of Parliament must be obeyed by the courts. This is not correct. Because, of course, in this country, common law has superiority. And therefore, if an act of Parliament is considered to be inappropriate by a jury, for example, the jury can nullify that act of Parliament. Later acts prevail over earlier ones. OK, external bodies cannot override acts of Parliament. The Bill of Rights and Magna Carta are important elements. Absolutely, they are. But to suggest that Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights are primary legislation and could be amended is not correct. And in fact, that last sentence, the same applies to the Bill of Rights, which was an ordinary act of Parliament passed in the ordinary way. That is completely incorrect, because it was a special Parliament. It was not an ordinary Parliament. This Parliament, no Parliament had any part in the creation of Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights, because Magna Carta, a common law contract between the people and the Crown at the time, Bill of Rights is merely, as I say, a special Parliament ratifying the Declaration of Right, which was another common law contract. So, David, we're getting off to a pretty bad start here, because the British government doesn't seem to understand the constitutional situation.
Well, they do. What they don't want is the people to understand it. That's the key here. And that would suggest, really, that they were afraid of the people knowing exactly what the tooling and the correct deployment of the Constitution could allow. So it's an awareness campaign, really. But to say that it's not written down, that's a complete misrepresentation, because there's quite a lot of it written on vellum in the rolls. So that's a nonsense. So I think we've got to come back to the way that, yes, the contractual stuff here and the tri-party aspect of it. But there's a huge amount of constitutional traffic and chatter now coming out of numerous MPs and numerous factions and all over the place in the media. And there's it's probably, shall we say, good reason for that.
Well, indeed. And of course, let's just bring this back on screen, because, of course, the conversation over the last few days has partly been about whether the Queen made some kind of intervention into Brexit at her Women's Institute meeting last week. But as Jacob Rees-Mogg was saying in his in the article in Politics Home, which was covering this, he was arguing that Downing Street had asked the Queen to make this intervention. And his the basis for this argument, he's saying, is that, of course, constitutionally, the Queen can't make such a statement. She can't get involved politically this way. She can only take advice from her ministers. And therefore, if she has made a statement, it's because her ministers, therefore number 10, have asked her to make this statement. So that's an interesting thing. Why would they be interested in the Queen intervening in this way? But as you say, other constitutional chatter. We've got a couple of examples here. Jacob Rees-Mogg himself on Twitter. Vernon Bognador understands the Constitution better than anyone else, so it's always worth listening to. And he's pointing to an article in The Times, which is called MPs Have Only One Way to Stop Brexit, the Brexit Deal Topple the Government. And then we have also Jack Montgomery here making the point that an immovable parliament is more obnoxious than a movable king, quoting Cromwell and Richard Harris, who acted as Cromwell in that film. So, and he's saying here that Jacob Rees-Mogg is right. If MPs bin their 2017 manifesto pledges to deliver Brexit and try to overturn the referendum, they delegitimise themselves. Parliament should be prorogued until the till exit day. So, as you say, quite a lot of chatter.
Isn't there an awful lot all of a sudden? But we have this issue really with the main sort of header there in the government, that they're not really... they don't really want us to use the Constitution properly. It's obviously there. It's well established if you want to research it and get into it. Where Jacob Rees-Mogg is concerned, I find that very, very interesting that he seems to be perhaps reiterating from within a second-tier circle and trying to get some traction for his position again after his votes of no confidence and this sort of thing. So that's possibly what's the motivation there. But he's particularly interesting to me because several years ago at the Bruges Group, I asked him a very specific question. I think this was at Tory Party conference where I was visiting, and it was off campus as the Bruges Group meetings normally are. And I asked him, were we about to away with the bauble with all this Brexit? This is before the Leave campaign. So I find that rather relevant now that we're in the position that we're in, seeing this stuff from Jack Montgomery coming back to Cromwell there, literally throwing the bauble off the table in the film. So we haven't replaced the divine right of kings only to have replace it with the divine right of parliament.
So that's I think sorry, David, I'm just going to interrupt there because I think it's important, since you raised that issue, But we're not really looking at the divine right of parliament here. We're looking at the divine right of government. And this is something that if we'd had this conversation 5 years ago, we might have said that parliament was misbehaving and that we were looking at parliament assuming they had a divine right. But in fact, if we look what's happened, well, maybe going back 30 years, but particularly in the last half dozen years or so, we've seen government trying to sideline parliament in every possible way. So... Yeah. Perhaps Parliament is relearning its constitutional position to a point, but it still hasn't quite got there yet.
Almost definitely, yeah. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. You know, we've got a... I mean, we've seen all this, as Brian and yourselves have articulated really well over previous news broadcasts, that, you know, the MPs are getting bent information. They're getting bent information from within their own parties that have been led like a load of headless chickens. They're not being briefed correctly from within the engine room there, the cabinet office. All that stuff's just complete tosh. It's coming out of the dirty seven currently. So, yes, you're quite right. It's a question of the divine right of this thing called government, which seems to sort of rest with about seven or eight people. So that's really where we've got to come back to. And, of course, it's Parliament's job. It's the only instrument that we've got available as the people, where it's their job to protect as governance. They are the governance for us, to protect our rights, privileges and freedoms. Now, and that's the one thing I will agree with here, that unless they stick to this to the manifesto that they've been elected into and deliver this leaving of the EU, then they're all in breach. And of course, that then puts the crown and the queen in breach of her oath. And of course, that's something that's not allowed. And there's the conflict. There's the variance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the question is, what are they trying to do here? Constitution suddenly becoming part of the conversation. But in the meantime, we had Matt Hancock on the Andrew Marr show over the weekend. And this has had many, many headlines over the weekend, with the mainstream media attempting to ramp this up to being something really scary. But is it what it seems? So, as I say, Matt Hancock on the Andrew Marr show, and Andrew Marr asked, is it the case that the government is looking at the possible of martial law and curfews if there is a no deal? And as I say, the mainstream media ramping this up as if it's you know, something to be scared of. And we've got to ask, is that really what we're looking at? He replied by saying, well, I wouldn't put a stress on martial law. Of course, government at all the time looks at all of those options in all circumstances. So they're talking about martial law. And the first question then is, how would they implement a martial law in the UK? And the answer is, as the UK column has been talking about for 6 or 7 years now, the piece of legislation is the Civil Contingencies Act. Now, I've got to thank the people that alerted me to the particular clause out of the Civil Contingencies Act that we want to look at today and the implications of it. Because in Section 2, Number 23, limitations of emergency regulations. 5, emergency regulations may not amend A, this part of the Act, or B, the Human Rights Act 1998. Now, I find that's very interesting because, of course, the Human Rights Act 1998 is a piece of statutory legislation which is European in its origins and European in its style and doesn't fit terribly well with the British Constitution, which is based on the common law and common law principles. And if we look historically over the decades, over the hundreds of years of common law in the British Constitution, of course, each major document may have its own articles within there, but they tend to be a restatements of certain common law principles that we all assume that we have, one of which is the idea of inalienable God-given rights and the principle that human beings have the right to do anything unless they're prohibited by law, whereas the European model is quite the opposite. You're permitted to do nothing unless you're permitted by law. So anyway, the Human Rights Act comes under that, so it's not really a constitutional document. But those are the only two limitations on any amendment by government of any legislation while the Civil Contingencies Act is in force. And the problem with that is that during the debate for this act, because it's very important when you look at an Act of Parliament, the way our parliamentary system works, it's very important that you don't just look at the words on the page of the Act of Parliament itself. You've got to go back to Hansard and read the debates that surrounded the Act of Parliament, because then you get an idea of the intent of the words. In this case, it was there was an effort by Conservative and Liberal Democrat peers in the House of Lords to add other laws to this list of limitations on the Civil Contingencies Act, and they lost that effort. And so what acts were they attempting to add to this? Well, we had Habeas Corpus Act 1679, we had the Bill of Rights 1689, the clause in the Parliament Act 1911 that limits the duration of a parliament to 5 years. We had the Act of Settlement 1701, the House of Commons Disqualification Act 1975, the Life Peerages Act 1958, and the House of Lords Act 1999. So a number of acts, including, David, some really key constitutional acts like the Bill of Rights. Now, why is the Bill of Rights important? We'll come on to that in 1 second. But as we said earlier, the Bill of Rights was not passed in a normal parliament. So this parliament, in fact, should not be trying to put its hands on it at all. But if we have under emergency legislation, an effort by a government to amend or remove or repeal fundamental parts of our constitution, perhaps we get to the bottom of what this suggestion of of civil contingencies is really about. It's not about martial law. It's about trashing the Constitution.
It's a very good way of looking at it, because we can see a direction of travel currently in what's coming out in government and parliament, and it's not good. So you've got to ask the question, how are they going to, what's the legal, mechanical and procedural way of them continuing with this sort of marriage into the EU? It's not a divorce. It's a nonsense to consider it as a divorce. It's a marriage. So where we've got this, you know, continual coming back to Henry VIII with Thomas More and the powers that people are talking about, the ministerial powers, that really we're seeing the council here trying to find a way, I think I'm agreeing with you, Mike, that mechanically they're trying to find a way of saying yes to the marriage, not no. And this is one way of getting their grubby mitts on the Bill of Rights. So this crisis lever, it seems to be a big lever in Europe as well. All of the big levers in Europe are designated under the EU declaring a crisis. And, you know, as we now know, that they can mobilise and unify the military in a day to 2 days. So that's the level of trouble that we're in. So that's going to be really interesting, because there's a whole void of acumen amongst the MPs on the Bill of Rights to start with. So if they're going, if there's some dark forces there in government that want to start molesting it, it's going to be easy, because there isn't the consensus there at the moment to stand with it and know exactly what's contained within it to start with. Because obviously the current, if you're a new MP and you've got a new Erskine May, there's nothing in it that will help you. You have to have a 1924 version to see anything of really what's contained within the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So that's, yeah, that's, it's a huge hurdle.
That's a very good point. So, but the question is then, why would they be going for the Bill of Rights? Now, by coincidence, over the weekend in Conservative Home, we had Richard Kemp and Lee Rotherham. The backstop's not the only danger in May's deal. Its defence plans will undermine NATO. And what they're saying, that this week's Aachen summit declaring closer integration between Germany and France in defence and foreign policy will inevitably give rise to headlines about EU military force. Commentators here in the UK often describe these developments as risible and unnecessary, like endless EU directives on cucumbers, and they look no further. But neglecting the details and the hazardous effects for the UK is a serious error. They go on to say, so how does defence creep into the Brexit negotiations? The Barnier model envisages a deal comprising four pillars, each of two are the old justice and home affairs and defence pillars, re-established from Maastricht Treaty days. The Chequers approach also envisaged a form of pillar structure in which both form separate units. In both cases, close institutional cooperation is anticipated, and Parliament does not seem to have been given much opportunity to consider the ramifications or its ability to provide future oversight and safeguard national interests. Consequently, I've reviewed the very recent history of these developments in a new paper, Brexit's Troubled Flank, the Departure Deal and EU Defence Integration, written by Lee Rotherham. And that paper is available on the Veterans for Britain website. They say the paper sheds light on the EU Common Security and Defence Policy alongside its twin, the Common Foreign and Security Policy, which take an indisputable course of direction towards the declared aim of a common defence. We show how it has taken place over five phases and how advancing apace with a mandate that unblocks major integrational opportunities for the EU. We briefly explain how this process is a part of a wider horizon of integration across a range of other policy areas, meaning that firewalling within a close association agreement with the EU, such as Chequers provides, is ultimately an impossible task. And we can contextualise UK historic engagement on defence with its European neighbours from the Treaty of Dunkirk onwards, showing the policy bipolarity between the sure anchor of NATO and the flexing shift from multilateral intergovernmental arrangements between European states that the EU is now authorised to swallow up. And one of the points that they make here, David, is that the EU defence structures, the generation of common assets and common units, thus providing the kernel of a future common European standing army. Now, this is vitally important, David, because although it may not look like it to people that aren't British, The fact is that Britain doesn't have a standing army. Britain it hasn't had a standing army since 1688. We cut off the head of a king in order to prevent the monarch having a standing army. And so parliamentary approval is required for us to have an army or a military at all, and it's required for us to deploy it in the way that Parliament sees fit. If, under the Civil Contingencies Act, the Bill of Rights, which is the act which removed the ability for Britain to have a standing army, if that act then falls under the remit of parliamentary amendment unconstitutionally, then perhaps what we're looking at here is the British government setting themselves up to be in a position where they have a standing army that they can commit to defence union, because of course they couldn't really enter any treaties on defence union if they don't have a standing army to commit to that treaty from Parliament to the next, from one Parliament to the next.
Absolutely correct. Yeah. And there's the stumbling block, isn't it? It's a huge bureaucratic, legal, you know, cabinet office job to try and undertake. So, you're bang on it there, Mike, with that analysis. So we've got several things here, really, that are wrong from the start off, because, as we know, that military unification to defence union has not been included in the Brexit debate. It has not been evaluated by Parliament. It has not been evaluated by MPs. It has not been discussed openly by MPs. You know, only the odd spurt here and there, but nothing of any substance. So we see this paper here from Kemp and Rotherham, and they're using some of the inverse, you know, anti-magic words. They're using integration. Well, of course, we're not integrating. We're unifying to single point command and control. So we've got a really sort of, you know, it's soft language what they're using there in this paper. It doesn't really sort of take the gloves off and give people the proper warnings as to really what we're dealing with. So I've got to say there's a sort of deficit there, really, in the magnitude of the language that they should be using. It's just way too soft. Nobody's going to sort of think that there's anything really here to be worried about, but it's something that we've seen over and over again. And the only way that we're going to get a consensus and majority is if we cite this thing for actually what it is, because we now know that the EU are afraid to use the term defence union, and yet we see our own MPs not using the phrase as well. So are they afraid? We're seeing really the stumbling block here, because if they want to proceed with this, they've got the absolute immovable bit in the Bill of Rights that you can't have a standing army. And that is exactly what the EU wants. So the question is that what the government wants? So that's the context of our question and the frame.
It absolutely is. And, you know, I can just imagine the situation where we have violence on the streets, similar to what we're seeing in France. Civil Contingencies Act is invoked. And while all the headlines are focused on what's going on the streets, we have this act of constitutional barbarism going on under the surface. We find ourselves pushed into a unified military Europe-wide on the basis of an amendment of an act, the Bill of Rights, that the UK Parliament doesn't really have the power to amend. So that's a pretty dangerous situation. Anyway, David, look, we'll move on to the next subject here, unless you've got something quickly you want to add.
Yeah, everyone, if you have a look on Mike's Twitter feed, so the pinned tweet is a vote. Do you think Her Majesty's Armed Forces should be part of EU Defence Union? And there are three questions. Please look at it, take the vote, share it as broadly as you possibly can amongst your own networks, because this is the thing that we're going to need really to air this. And it's anchored off a reply to Lord Ashcroft.
So as everybody knows, if you want to find my Twitter feed, you can find me at MikeUKC, at MikeUKC. Now, let's move on to what is going on in France. And of course, the Yellow Vests. Protests continue over the weekend, and well, we've got had a Jerome Rodriguez, one of the high profile members of the Yellow Vest movement, hit with a flashball apparently, and well, he seems to have lost his eye. As you can see, he was hit in the eye by this. Allegations that he was being targeted by the police, that he had been spotted by the police and was targeted by the police. There's now an investigation into this. I don't think too many people hold out any hope that there would be any particularly positive outcome for it. But in the meantime, we're starting to see other groups appear. So RT was discussing the red scarves over the weekend, and they were holding a counter demonstration in Paris. Now, what's really interesting about the red scarves, David, is that this is a much more organized protest group. So they've got a proper website. It's actually set up as an association in France, formerly created as a sort of small business. They're calling themselves the Foulard Rouge, as I say, and they are claiming that they want to see an end to the violence of the Yellow Vest rallies. People are tired of the roadblocks, they say. They're bad for business, and children are prevented from getting to school on time. We denounce the insurrectional climate installed by the Yellow Vests. We also reject the threats and constant verbal abuse aimed at non-Yellow Vests. And so this seems to be a rival group, but as I say, much more formally organized. They're very, very keen that instead of getting out on the streets and protesting in the way that the Yellow Vests are, that people take part in Emmanuel Macron's Grand Debate rather than throwing stones and so on. So, but that's not all. There's another group on its way up as well. They're calling themselves the Blue Vests. So, David, this very much looks like the counter gangs starting to appear. And, of course, that's very much a divide and conquer tactic. And certainly the red scarves attempting to encourage people to get involved in Macron's grand debate process. Well, if anybody was listening to the Sunday Wire last night, 21st Century Wire, they'd have heard Vanessa Bailey talking about that and about just exactly how that's no debate at all, because what is happening is that Macron is closing the discussion down to very limited subjects, and also making sure that only certain people are allowed to take part in those. So gangs and counter gangs apparently starting to build up in France now.
Yeah, it's an old recipe, isn't it? You know, divide and conquer, and even better if you can divide and divide, which is clearly what we're seeing. So if there's groups upon groups, it's a lot easier. It's a lot easier for Macron to sweep up and mop this up. And it doesn't look like there's a lot of debate going on with that guy. So they need to have a think about what they're really doing in France.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, yeah, no, I was just saying, you're absolutely right. There's no debate happening with Macron at all. So anyway, we will keep an eye on that. In the meantime, the injuries continue to build. The police coming under quite a bit of pressure. They're now being forced to wear body cameras and so on. But whether there are going to be any actual prosecutions on the police side, well, that remains to be seen. In the meantime, in the United States, all kinds of shenanigans going on there. Roger Stone, who, of course, is one of Donald Trump's close advisors, was arrested over the weekend, pre-dawn FBI raid. But what was really interesting was it was done, CNN was invited along with their cameras. They were broadcasting live and so on. Fantastic stuff. Apparently, they have issued an indictment against Roger Stone for lying to Congress, and also about some emails that he sent containing which they claim amount to obstruction of justice and witness tampering. So what it looks like they're attempting to do is to try to get Stone to spill the beans on Trump, if there are any beans to be spilt. I think that this is just another example of the Mueller investigation really clutching at straws here and just really trying to intimidate the people that are around Trump. So Roger Stone being pretty defiant about this. He's been wearing various T-shirts with slogans on them and so on following what's happened. But nonetheless, the intimidation is pretty significant. But if we move on to Venezuela then, David, I'm just going to start off with a quick video of Alan Duncan at the United Nations.
I'm very grateful to the United States for convening this very important meeting here this morning. I think the world can see that Venezuela is in a state of complete collapse. The misery of its people has been caused by one man and his cronies, President Maduro. The world is now looking at him and concluding that he is no longer the legitimate president of Venezuela. His corruption, his cheating at elections are not acceptable. We will be discussing this in the Security Council in a minute. I will have something specific to say when I make my words clear there.
I always find it a little bit ironic, David, when any British politician stands up and accuses any other country of election fraud and corruption. But anyway, that's what he had to say. He went on in Parliament then to really say this. We need an end to tyranny in Venezuela, an end to corruption, an urgent return to freedom, democracy, and the rule of law. And this is from a government which, as far as I can see, doesn't respect the rule of law in any way, shape, or form. We've been discussing that in the first half of the program. So Jeremy Hunt was over in the States a couple of days ago, I guess, to get organized around this. He met Pompeo, Secretary of State in the US. And of course, Pompeo then went to that Security Council meeting and basically used words which were very similar to George Bush's words following 9/11. You know, you're either with us or you're against us, sort of thing. But this is clear regime change, David.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and we've got Mr. Duncan. Oh, sorry, Sir Alan Duncan, isn't it? That he would does he have himself as a judge, jury, and executioner in this sort of stuff? I mean, who's he to talk to anybody about election fraud and, you know, misbehaving with sort of democracy and one through another, considering we've had the vote in this country and we voted to believe, and he's one of the main cornerstones of preventing that from happening. He talks of tyranny. Well, that's what the EU is. The EU is a tyrannical system. You know, I mean, honestly, the hypocrisy from this man is just it's disgusting. But, you know, you've got this. You've got this sort of double standard stuff. Who on earth is he to credibly talk to anybody about anything? Sorry.
Well, absolutely. But it doesn't end there, because apparently the City of London is getting involved as well, and the Bank of England. And Venezuela gold, which is being deposited at the Bank of England, is apparently not allowed to be sent back. $1.2 billion of gold. Now, of course, this is always the problem with any kind of sanctions. You might call this a sanction. That the people that suffer most as a result are the ordinary people in the street. So you know, we're going to withhold $1.2 billion of gold from Venezuela to make sure that that this particular government continues to not be able to feed its own people, which then gives the Western governments, United States, UK, Europe, the ability to claim that they need to intervene in some way. So this is a pretty nasty development.
It's a very nasty development, and it's telling you that there's going to be some military action. That would be the normal forecast in these sorts of cascade of events. There's some hypocrisy there, though, as well, considering what the gold swapping and whatnot was going on through World War II. Yeah, so you're gonna see this is really all about the oil in Venezuela, and of course oil dollar dollar oil, and this is what the problem is. It's about I've seen some sort of video of Trump saying that if only they'd cut a deal and give us half the oil, it wouldn't be a problem. So you know, you can see that that's where it clearly lies. This is about who's going to control, and clearly they're in sort of stage four of the whole process there, the final weeks of civil unrest and decomposition, where you know, a dictator is going to be installed. But it depends on whose side gets in there to dis- to install which way.
Alan Duncan said that if new elections aren't announced within 8 days, then Britain will automatically recognise Juan Guaido as the interim Venezuelan president. And of course, they rely on him to restore democracy, the economy, and the freedom of the people. I don't think that's a likely outcome.
No, the likely outcome is it'll look like it'll start to go down the pathway that like a rerun of Iraq. It'll be a similar thing to that. There'll just be some kind of ghastly war.
Yes.
But it's really what the other countries in the world are going to do or not do about that.
It's what we're going to do or not do about that, because of course, are we going to permit Parliament and the government to take any kind of action? I'm not sure that the British government is considering that, but the United States government is. Perhaps we need to be putting a bit of pressure on the British government to make sure that doesn't happen.
I absolutely agree. It can't be the correct way of going about this sort of thing. You know, there needs to be proper dialogue and get to grips with the situation and stop the, you know, the suffering is engineered. The people have been made to suffer. You know, so we look at that as the corner of it, and then work the correct way round.
Yes. Oh, okay. Well, look, David, thank you very much. We will leave it there for today. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to everybody else for joining us as well. We will be back at the same time on Wednesday, 1 p.m., and Brian will be back in the studio then. We shall see you then. Bye-bye.